Possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. Registration is not required and individuals can join at any time. For more information, call 384-5829 or www.livingyogacenter.net.
Hello, this is Carol Spindell. I'm sitting in today for Celeste Quinn, and our guest today is Joyce Carol Oates. She is the author of numerous short stories and over 30 novels, has won major literary awards, including the National Book Award in 1970 for Them, and most recently in 2003 received the Kenyon Review Award for Literary Achievement and the Commonwealth Award for Distinguished Service in Literature. She is the Roger S. Berlind Distinguished Professor of the Humanities at Princeton University. And today we're going to be talking about her new novel, The Falls. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Joyce Carol Oates.
Thank you.
Listeners are, of course, invited to join our conversation with a question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And if you're in Urbana or Champaign, the number is 333-9455. I don't expect our readers to have read The Falls yet. It's just out. But the book opens in 1950. It's dawn. A mist hangs over Niagara Falls. And a gatekeeper, a man who sells tickets to tourists, sees a young man run onto the walkway and climb over the rail. It's a very ominous beginning. It has a sort of Shakespearean tragic quality. Was this the first image that occurred to you when you began to write the book?
Well, writing a novel, especially a long, rather complicated, ambitious novel, it's like a river into which many tributaries are flowing. So I'm not sure if that's the very first image. Probably for me, the very first image was simply the falls itself.
Well, the falls is certainly a powerful character in this book. But the young man who disappears into the water, we learn that he has been married the day before and that he has come to Niagara Falls on his honeymoon. And, of course, he leaves a bride behind. There's this awkward, red-haired young woman who's wandering around the hotel looking for her groom. It seems the year 1950, the place Niagara Falls. This has to be the emblematic American wedding night. It's like the iconic honeymoon of honeymoons, isn't it?
Yes, a nightmare reversal of the expectations. But the 1950s seems so long ago to us now, and there were expectations about marriage and virginity before marriage that are not exactly, you know, the prevailing mores today.
It's true, and the tragedy of this young man's death is really grounded in the American realities of that time, in the expectations of religion and family and so on that he is under.
Yes, he really is perhaps bisexual or gay. The word gay, of course, didn't exist in the 1950s, but he would not want to think of himself as homosexual. It's a thought he could never, never have accepted, and so it's easier in a way for him just to destroy himself in an impulsive, irrevocable act.
Well, I was reminded, you tell that opening scene several different ways. First, we see it through the gatekeeper's eyes, and I was almost reminded of a Shakespearean play opening, this very peripheral character who we'll never see again, who kind of comes out onto the stage and says, now the story will begin.
Yes, that's right. He's the gatekeeper who opens the gate. Yes.
Well, then there's his bride, of course, Araya, and they come to call her the Widow Bride of the Falls, and she waits 7 days for her husband's body to surface there at the beautiful Rainbow Grand Hotel. And then the book follows Araya for the next 28 years, from 1950 to 1978. She remarries. She has three children. She's widowed again. And we've come to know the landscape of Niagara Falls. We come to know several of its neighborhoods. We see how it changes as more and more chemical plants locate there. Finally, we readers have to face the ugly reality of toxic dumping and the place we call Love Canal. You said in your author's notes, though there are numerous elements of historical and geographical accuracy in this portrait of Niagara Falls, New York, it should be stressed that the city and its environs are finally mythological. And I was wondering if you could tell us, how does a real city become a mythological city through the process of fiction?
Well, I think what I'm trying to suggest is that because it's a novel, there are important changes. I will invent some place names. I will invent some geographical areas. Maybe I'll invent an island or a neighborhood. Basically, it is really Niagara Falls, and some of the statistics that are included in the novel are authentic. It's just that as a novelist, I have to have a certain margin that is more given over to the imagination. So I always have a disclaimer like that. And, of course, Niagara Falls as a city has become somewhat mythologized anyway. And most tourists who visit it have no idea what the city's like. I mean, they don't know about industrial Niagara Falls.
Mm-hmm.
They're only focused on the tourist areas. And often they go to the Canadian Falls because the view from Canada is more stunning.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, if you had not used Niagara Falls, it seems to me, if you had invented, say, a waterfall where tourists went, it wouldn't have the same iconic meaning for us and the same...
No, not at all. And then the city with its industrialization, that was very important.
And then, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I grew up near this area, so for me it's more than just an arbitrary landscape. It's something that I grew up near.
And that comes out in the book. There are many intimate details that as a reader, although I know this area not at all, I feel strongly this is written by someone who knows this place intimately.
Yes, I know how the natives of Niagara Falls feel about tourists and how people who live there don't have any interest in the falls. I mean, if you're living near a tourist attraction, you basically are not that interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other place and the other two words that have that powerful symbolism for us and iconic meaning are Love Canal, this place we call Love Canal. I think it's quite early in the book when someone makes a joke and something about it. We don't need hell here in Niagara Falls. We have Love Canal.
Right, right.
And as a reader, a kind of shiver went down my back. Oh, dear, Love Canal.
Right, and in the 1950s, of course, the novel does go into the 1970s and takes us through a lot of litigation and so forth. But in the 1950s, the words Love Canal did not have the connotations that they have today. Today, if you say Love Canal, it's a symbol. It's like a buzzword for a polluted cityscape and for litigation that went on for decades before it finally came to some good resolution. But when this novel begins, Love Canal doesn't exist in that way. It's like women's liberation would not have been a term that had any consciousness in the 1950s.
Right. Well, when you make these decisions as you write this novel and you're saying, okay, this is the real place, this I'll use the real name, this is this park, this is this street, are you ever torn about how to draw that line?
Oh, yes, I think it's something that has to be calibrated and thought of quite carefully. A few years ago, I wrote a novel about Norma Jean Baker, who becomes Marilyn Monroe, and that novel is called Blonde. And there, I didn't invent very many episodes in Marilyn Monroe's life, but I had to imagine them. And what I did as a novelist was to eliminate a lot. I selected details and then eliminated others. That's the main thing a writer does in writing about anything that's historically real or a geographical place. You find that you're selecting details, selecting place, names, streets, and then just ignoring other material because you can't organize so much material.
I read recently that you said you hope to approach your writing without anxiety, tension, and apprehension. And I couldn't resist asking you, after over 30 novels, doesn't it get easier?
No, it doesn't. No, I can't say that it does. I think in an odd way, when you're a young writer, and I would include my own students at Princeton, the writing is easier. There's an ease and a fluency, almost a confidence that comes out of the fact that the young writer doesn't know how many mistakes he or she is making.
Mm-hmm.
And the students just can write without feeling that they're writing sentences that are banal or awkward or trite, or they're writing a story that's already been written about a dozen times. These questions don't come to young writers, but they definitely come to older writers. You're trying to do something that's a little different from what you've done before. You want to avoid writing something that somebody else has written. You're much more conscious of the way sentences are structured. And there's a heightened consciousness and self-expectation that the beginning writer just doesn't have.
Well, I guess that's the joy of naivete.
Yes, yes, the sort of confidence. I think young athletes have that too, maybe anyone who's young, just not knowing how difficult it's going to be, not knowing how many years are going to go into just struggling.
Right. And if the Niagara Falls of this novel is a mythological place, do you see Dirk Burnaby, the handsome, affable, well-connected lawyer, who eventually takes on the case of the homeowners at Love Canal, do you see him as a mythic hero?
He is somewhat of a mythic hero. There were people in Niagara Falls in the 1950s who tried very hard to effect some social action. They tried to have lawsuits. They went to the courts. They tried to get lawyers. But mainly it was very, very frustrating. And I think years went by. They tried to draw petitions. They kept being met with obdurate resistance from city and county health officials. It was a much slower, longer, more difficult process than I make it in the novel, though it's fairly difficult in the novel, too. As I was saying before, if you're writing about a historical event, you have to simplify it to some degree.
Real life, I guess, is just way more chaotic than literature.
Yes, you're so right. The word chaotic, and the human mind can't really deal with chaos. When you're writing a novel, you're always looking for the story through line.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're making a movie, that there's a narrative that tells a story, there are characters. In real life, there may be 500 characters involved in a litigation, different kinds of people who are involved and expert witnesses. But if you're writing about it, you can only choose just a few.
Mm-hmm. And so in your novel, in a sense, Dick Burnaby, the, as I said, the well-connected lawyer, the son of Niagara Falls, stands in for the lawyers, I assume. And then there's this woman, Nina Oleshaker. He's driven in some way to help her, pulled in some way to help her. And then I assume that she sort of stands in for all these ordinary people who collected
That's
information.
Right. That's right. That's very well put. She does. She's more heightened, more operatic, more dramatic figure. And, of course, I give her language. I give her speech. I don't know what the actual people were doing and saying, but they were housewives and husbands and fathers who realized that their land was polluted, their children were being burnt playing outdoors, and the schoolyard was contaminated. And as I said before, they kept meeting such resistance on the part of city health officials. They would go to doctors with their complaints and their symptoms and be told, well, you may have this symptom because you smoke or you were born with it. So it's just a kind of unified front denying what seems to us common sense.
Well, I guess what's remarkable is that these people persevered.
They did persevere. It's really heartbreaking. So many of them came down with terrible illnesses. There were much more childhood leukemia in that area than is normal in the population.
Mm.
It's actually rather heartbreaking.
It is. One of the details that really I found so cruelly, tragically ironic was the chemical company selling the land to the Board of Education and then building for, I believe it's $1?
Yes, $1, yes.
And then they build an elementary school?
Exactly. They sold it for $1 and for the promise that there would never be any litigation. And that was broken as the decades went by. That got broken in court, that contract.
Well, that just seemed, I was compelled after finishing The Falls to go and look up a little bit about Love Canal. And I thought, well, perhaps she's made that crueler than it was, and there it was, exactly those facts. And I thought, oh, well, I'm so glad she didn't change those because those are so somehow perfect.
I know. There's so much there. And I didn't really put everything in because it would have been completely depressing and overwhelming. But it does have a kind of happy ending because decades later, the litigation is successful. The homeowners are compensated. It was declared a national disaster area by President Carter. And while it was never a happy story, it does have a resolution.
It does. And if Dirk Burnaby, the lawyer, is the mythic hero of the story, he's certainly flawed.
Oh, yes, he's flawed.
And he dies a hero's death. But then he is a bit resurrected in your final scene in which, as you say, there is a bit of a happy ending.
A bit of a happy ending because, of course, it's decades later. There's a new generation. And there's even a surprise visit by Ralph Nader in the last chapter.
Let me just remind our listeners that if you'd like to call and join this conversation with Joyce Carol Oates about her newest novel, The Falls, our phone numbers are 1-800-222-9455 or locally 333-9455. And this is Carol Spindell today sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Niagara Falls is such a powerful character in this novel. It might be like the most powerful character. It calls to people and they come, they succumb. And I think somewhere in your book you say that it has a particularly powerful effect on adolescents.
Yes, definitely. There's just something about the romance of such a beautiful setting. There are certain places in the world. Golden Gate Bridge is another, and the western coast of England is another. There's Mount Fuji, I think, in Japan, that are so beautiful that people are drawn to them in a kind of delusion, a romantic delusion, that this would be a beautiful place to kill myself. So they throw themselves off the Golden Gate Bridge or off over Niagara Falls. And the death that they experience is anything but romantic.
Well, you portray that so beautifully through the character of Juliet Burnaby, the daughter of Dirk Burnaby and Uriah, who hears this call, and she believes that it could be her father calling her.
Well, she thinks that her father may have committed suicide in the falls, but in fact we know that he was murdered. He was forced off the road, and so he dies in the falls. He was murdered because he's been involved in this litigation against the powerful chemical companies. And so she's grown up knowing that she's the daughter of someone who died in the falls, and she's very somewhat lonely adolescent, very sensitive girl. And in the household, the mother has forbidden them to ask about the father because the mother was so heartbroken. And so she is drawn, as you say, in this kind of romantic way.
And, you know, you grew up near Niagara Falls, I know, not far away, and it's clear that you know this landscape intimately. I was wondering, what do you think about our attitude toward landscape in American writing? It seems like we're very ambivalent about it, I feel, because on the one hand, when a writer renders a place well, we admire that, and reviews will often speak of it, and we like a place to be like a character. I know as a reader, I like that. But then, if a writer returns again and again to the same place or writes about the same kinds of people, we say that writer is a regional writer, and it's very dismissive.
Well, I guess that's an interesting point. There are some writers, like William Faulkner, who repeatedly return to their own area, And I guess Faulkner was a great enough writer, and his themes were so profound that he transcended that description. Eudora Welty, maybe a little more of a regional writer, or Flannery O'Connor, but they did manage, I think, mostly to escape that. But I think you're right generally.
It seems to be an odd contradiction.
I guess so. Yes, I hadn't thought of it.
I read something that you wrote in 1970 when you accepted the National Book Award, and I have to say I was really struck by it because it seemed to describe this novel, which just came out in 2004 and I assume was written in the last year or so, so concisely. And you said, I'll read your words back to our listeners and to you if you don't mind. In novels I have written, I have tried to give a shape to certain obsessions of mid-century Americans, a confusion of love and money, of the categories of public and private experience, of a demonic urge I sense all around me, an urge to violence as the answer to all problems, an urge to self-annihilation, suicide, the ultimate experience, and the ultimate surrender. The use of language is all we have to pit against death and silence.
That is very interesting. I haven't heard that in many years. So thank you.
Well, it describes this novel perfectly.
I guess it does in many ways.
It begins exactly at the mid-century in 1950.
Yeah, it's uncanny.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, do you feel that this is the project you have been working towards, or that these themes, you're drawn to subjects that have these themes, or you bring them out? How do you account for that?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm always interested in family stories as they attach themselves to something larger. So I have a number of family novels that are also rather large, ambitious novels that take in society and popular culture and politics. And I don't have that many of these novels because often I'm writing something that's not quite as complicated. But that would certainly describe the longer novels like them.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is bitter and because it is my heart.
Right. Well, it just seemed to me a perfect description of this book.
Well, it really is.
And then you say at the end, the use of language is all we have to pit against death and silence. I assume this is your credo as a fiction writer.
Well, yes, I think our species is known for its language. We have a very highly developed language. Our brains are just fine-tuned to deal with language and its subtleties, and of course with mathematics and symbols. And so that is what makes us different from the other species of animals and creatures. And so that is what we have, you know. It's one of the things we have anyway. We also have emotions that attach themselves to other people, and we have an urge toward altruism that may be unique to our species.
That comes out in Dirk Burnaby's taking on this case, which is a bit out of character.
It would have been out of character until he actually met the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that any kind of discrimination against ethnic groups, or anti-Semitism, for instance, is a good example, that these inclinations dissolve when you actually meet the people.
Mm-hmm.
You meet the objects of your projections. You've been projecting demonic emotions onto other people. Then when you meet them, you meet the individuals, you discover they're just like yourself. And so to me, that is a basic feature of what literature can do, what art can do, where you bring people into a world that's a little different from their own. They meet people different from themselves, and they feel an expansion of sympathy.
Well, he is, in a way, a man who's drawn to protect women.
He is, yes.
And just as he protected the young widow bride and married her and fell in love with her, Araya, he then meets this young housewife whose child has died of leukemia and who's struggling to do something about this. She
doesn't seem
really sure what.
Yes, well, I think we all have, or most of us have, a certain protective urge. And this man does. Many men have it to protect women and children, and women have it. I feel that way a little bit. I feel very nurturing toward my students, for instance.
Uh-huh. Well, that's, they're very fortunate then.
Well, it's just sort of natural. I think it comes with the territory if you're a professor.
I know. I feel the same way. I think it comes a little bit with age, too. You think, they have so much youthful energy, and you want to help them along.
They're so touching. They're so idealistic.
Yeah. I was going to say, too, that Araya, in this battle between language and silence, Araya is a very curious character. And as readers, I think we're often very frustrated with her.
Well, she's very quirky and eccentric and hard to get to know. If we had ever met her, she would be very difficult to get to know. She's the woman in the neighborhood who doesn't come out on her porch. She's the one woman on the block who doesn't make friends with the other wives and mothers. She just sort of keeps to herself. She thinks she's a little better than the others. She's definitely better educated. She's from a better home, in a sense, but she's just one of these quirky neighborhood characters.
And she silences her own children.
Well, she doesn't want to talk about their missing father because it was so painful. She loved him so desperately and so completely that she became insanely jealous of him. This is the other side of very passionate romantic love, that we can become very jealous. And Araya fell into that trap.
She did. She doesn't understand that the family, why he takes on this case and why he is so obsessed with it.
No, it's a kind of maddening quality. I wanted to show someone who was actually quite a devoted mother, but her devotion is too much. She's possessive, and she's so desperate that her children be shielded from harm that she tries to almost suffocate them and keep them at home. And one by one, of course, they leave her.
They do, and that's a very beautifully written part, I think, when they struggle with leaving her, because they do genuinely love her. But each of them, in turn, realizes that to grow up, they've got to leave her.
That's right. And at the end of the novel, she's acknowledging that, too. She suddenly realizes that it's a new era, and she's going to forgive her husband. She doesn't know he had actually been murdered. She doesn't realize that it wasn't his fault, that he never came home that night. But it's a new era, and she does appear out in public, and she becomes something of a recluse, suffering from a kind of agoraphobia and just not going out much. But then she does go out. So the novel is really ending in a new era.
It's a nice note to have it end on. I mean, there are so many dark points in the novel. It has a very dark beginning and then goes down into many dark places. And it's nice to come out into that sunshine.
Well, I think it's so true just in terms of younger generations that an older generation may have made some mistakes, and yet the younger people come along and they get to be in their late teens and early 20s and they become adults and they see things differently. And what seems so tragic and mired down in the past, for them it isn't.
They haven't lived it.
No, they haven't lived it. They're going to meet new people. They're going to fall in love. They'll have their own children. And it's just sort of the wheel turning, and that's the way life is.
I was struck, too, by this couple who are so much in love. They are so very close in so many ways. And yet, when the story of Love Canal begins to enter the book, and just dribs and drabs, a little bit of consciousness of it starts to creep in, they react so differently. Araya, the wife, will not even look at a newspaper. She finds the headlines very unsettling.
Yes, I know people like that. I could almost be that way myself sometimes. She's just going to think, well, I have my house, I have my family, I'm going to take care of them. I just can't deal with the society outside my house. Whereas Dirk can deal with it, and he tries to, and he does what he can. Ultimately, he fails. Ultimately, he's destroyed, but he can't not try to help.
It's really quite remarkable, the short journey he takes, because he is a son of privilege. And he is, as someone calls him in the book, a traitor to his class.
That's right. That's what FDR was called, a traitor to his class.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I was struck by that. It gradually dawns on him as he looks around. He sees the judge. He sees the other lawyers. He sees the mayor, the person at the Board of Education. And these are all his childhood friends. These are the people he plays poker with. And he suddenly realizes they will close ranks and there will be no justice here.
It's true, and that's the way it was. And it was there, the way it was there, and probably all over the world most of the time. If there's progress in terms of social justice, it's not easy. People have to really, really struggle, and many people give up their private lives.
It's remarkable in a way that he gets as far as he does, having come from the world he's come from.
That's right. It's because he sympathizes with the victims.
And in that sense, I guess I did see him as a mythic hero, because he takes that step outside his world and makes that journey to look at the world and understand it differently.
Yes, and that's why there's a memorial to him many years after his death, that though he had certain flaws, he made some mistakes. At the same time, he was a pioneer, and they wanted to honor him.
The moment when he shows his flaws in the courtroom, when he realizes there will be no justice here and it's all rigged and I can do nothing, he just loses it and he punches the bailiff.
Well, yeah, the bailiff was trying to calm him down. He sort of turned around instinctively. It's partly a consequence of his despair.
Yeah.
Been drinking.
And the daunting, overwhelming task he's taken on, it's just too big. He's got to do something.
Yes. Some people must have felt that way in the early civil rights movement when they were doing their peaceful sit-ins in the South and they were being billy-clubbed by police and dragged by their hair and thrown into prison. And they must have felt at times just such despair. I really don't know how they kept going.
I
admire people like that enormously. I just don't think I would personally have that kind of stamina and courage.
Right, I know what you mean. And that's, I thought, very beautiful about that moment when he becomes so human. And he really steps outside his class at that moment because, of course, he's been trained to always be the gentleman.
Yes, and there have been a number of people, of course, many people in history, I think, who have stepped outside their class and they've gone into public life. And they've tried to make things better for poorer classes, and they were perceived as traitors to their own class.
Yeah, he's really a very interesting character, Dirk Burnaby.
Yes, I liked him also. I tend to like all my characters. They seem to me very real.
Uh-huh. So even Araya, you get frustrated with her, but you continue to like her?
Well, there's certain qualities of Araya that I have myself. Her kind of skittishness and her paranoia, her anxiety, her quirks and foibles and odd things about her. For instance, she's so dead set against the children having a puppy because she knows that she will be the one who ends up taking care of the puppy. But then when the puppy's actually there in the kitchen, she says, oh, well, I might as well take care of you. What's one more? You know, and I'm like that, too. I have a certain theoretical opposition to something. But if somebody brought a puppy in the house, I'd probably take a look at it and say, oh, well, I guess I can do it. And that's the way she is.
And, of course, by the end, she and the dog are almost one. They're like shadow people of each other, shadow characters.
Completely bonded. The puppy grows into a dog, and it's the last gift that her husband gives the family, actually. So it's as if this dog is the spirit of the missing father, and Araya comes to love the dog immensely.
Well, you have often said in things I have read, interviews and so on, that one thing that really helps you write is running.
Oh, yes.
And I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Well, I love to run, and I run every day and as much as I can, actually. People ask me how far I run, but I don't really know how far. I try to run about an hour. Sometimes I don't have that much time, maybe half an hour. And the running is very liberating. The mind, I think, is shaken free of restraints, and you start thinking about things, maybe daydreaming and planning and working on problems that I think are just very, very invigorating in a way that it wouldn't be if I just stayed sitting at my desk.
And do you ever look around and suddenly think, oh, where am I?
No, I really love the nature, and we run on country roads and in fields. I'm from the rural world of upstate New York, so I come from a farm area, and I really like to see that kind of world here in New Jersey. I love wild flowers, and I love wild fields, and we run sometimes in fields, and so I'm very much looking at that.
The fields, the light, the landscape.
Wild, and right now, in September, the wildflowers are so beautiful.
Mm.
It just breaks your heart to think that the frost is coming.
I know. Don't remind me. We have the prairie here, which is a beautiful place to walk also. And the light, particularly in this time of year, is very beautiful.
It is. But then it isn't so wonderful in the winter when the wind is blowing so hard.
And do you run all winter?
Oh, I don't think I can do it too easily. It depends on how cold it is.
Yeah.
I'm not one of these people who runs in all different weathers.
Well, that's interesting. I think people often wonder, what keeps writers going? This seems so lonely day after day. And I know that you've often answered that question with running, which...
That's true, but I also teach.
Uh-huh.
And I have friends, and so I'm not completely alone. I have a household here, two cats and a husband.
Well, and do the cats help you write as well? Do they keep you company as you work?
They do a lot of serious sleeping.
Uh-huh.
And so they're not helping too much, but there they are. They're a good moral support. I don't know if you like cats. I hope you do. But having a cat on my lap purring is very consoling.
Is it? Okay. Well, I think I probably like the idea of cats better than cats themselves.
Do you like dogs?
I do.
I do too, yeah.
Well, I liked your dog, Zario, in this book.
Isn't he sweet?
He's a very loyal dog. He really is.
A very loyal dog, yes.
Now, one thing, in your literary life, you've been criticized a lot for being prolific. Does that bother you?
No, that doesn't really. I think everybody has to be criticized for something. And since I'm obviously, seemingly, to other people, prolific, that is what I would be criticized for. I could be criticized for not writing enough, but that wouldn't be appropriate.
It seems like such an odd criticism.
Well, as I say, people have to be critical in some way, and I more or less accept the criticism. I think when you step into public life and you're trying to be a writer or any kind of artist, you have to accept that many people will resent you and many people will just not like what you're doing. And if you can't tolerate that kind of criticism, then you can't really be in public life. This is even more true for politicians. They have to be able to bear all kinds of criticism and slurs and mudslinging and terrible things said about them.
Yeah, we certainly see that right now.
We see it, and it's very troubling because we also can infer that many people of integrity do not want to go into public life anymore.
I think it's very true. It's hard for me to imagine how someone would have the courage to deal with that day after day.
Yeah, it didn't used to be quite that bad.
I don't think so.
It was always somewhat harsh. But it wasn't that bad decades ago. The scurrilousness and the gossip that comes out today, and also the innuendo and lies, I don't think that our ancestors had to deal with that too much. I mean, obviously, Harry Truman and FDR and Eisenhower and John Kennedy, I mean, they were obviously criticized, but there wasn't this kind of personal, deeply offensive attacks.
Yeah, they were shielded in some way from the worst of it.
They were shielded. The media was not so merciless.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that you said, I found in 1980, you talked about, you said, I anticipate a greater use of historical and nonfiction elements in fiction, but a wild and surrealist employment of these elements in the service of a metaphoric vision. And I certainly see in The Falls the use of historical and nonfiction elements, but I guess I was really struck by that word, surrealist. I was wondering, do you see some of your language or imagery as surrealist?
To me, surrealism has much to do with the human imagination. It's the kind of processes we experience in dreams. And so while it's surreal, and in a sense unreal, it's also very natural. When we fall asleep and dream, the dreams are often very bizarre and unpredictable and really weird, but we have to accept that they must be natural, too. So a lot of my writing does spring from the human mind, like if Juliet's walking along toward the falls, or she thinks she hears the voices in the falls, we can suppose that really she's hearing them in her own mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean by surrealism. I don't often write in a traditionally surrealist way. I don't often write in a fantastic way.
No, well, I would certainly call this a realistic novel.
This is completely realistic. That's right. Everything that happens is very real. But some of the thoughts that people have may verge upon the surreal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the unconscious and the surreal are so linked. But I was curious if you, when I saw that use of the word surrealism, if you would ever be drawn to write a more surreal novel. Have you ever thought about that?
I've written several novels that I would call postmodernist gothic. One of them is called Bellefleur. One is called The Bloods of a Romance, and the other Mysteries of Winterturn. And I wrote them in the 1980s or late 1970s. And these novels are much more surreal. They're realistic in other ways, too. But they sort of straddle the line between the realistic novel and the gothic novel.
Yeah, I think many of us who've read some of those novels often hear the word gothic appended to them and accept it.
Right. Edgar Allan Poe was a gothic writer. Of course, he was his own self and very idiosyncratic. But he comes from a tradition of fantasy that is called gothic.
To return to The Falls and this ambitious idea of wedding these historical elements, fictional elements, political life, public life with private life, and creating this family who lives through these events, is it hard for you when you finish a book that all-encompassing?
Oh, yes, I miss it very much. I miss the characters, and so I do.
Do you have to go running more often?
Well, I feel kind of melancholy, but then I do a lot of revising. And because a novel is such a long, somewhat slow process, when you get your copy edited manuscript back, you can do more revising. And then the galleys come and you can do a little more. So it's more of a slow leave taking rather than an abrupt farewell.
And then at some point in that process, are you starting to think about the next one?
Well, usually I'm working on short things. I start. Uh-huh. I never do another novel right away because I don't have the stamina. So I do short things. I love short stories. I do book reviews and essays and poems. So it's a transition that I've come to find comforting.
Well, we just have a few minutes, Joyce Carol Oates. Tell us what you're working on now.
I'm working on short stories. I've done a number of stories over the summer. One just came out in the New Yorker this week, and I have a couple of others I've been working on. So it's a nice respite from the exhaustion of writing a long novel.
Well, this is certainly a very compelling novel, and I know many of our listeners who have read your other books will be looking for it and reading it, and I certainly enjoyed reading it very much.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure to have you here with us today, and thank you so much for joining us on the Afternoon Magazine.
It was delightful. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And now for the numbers from the Merck and the Chicago Board of Trade, here is Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. We'll get to the numbers from both the Merck and the Chicago Board of Trade in just a moment. Dave Dickey, hard at work here this afternoon. I've got a couple of numbers that I do want to go through with you very quickly. Dave put together the weekly changes from last Friday to this Friday, and there's some interesting things that were happening, especially in the bean pit. The January contract and the beans were off 57 and three quarters for the week. That's from Friday's trade to Friday trade at 560 and three quarters, the settlement price in the Novembers, which are now the new lead option because the September, which expired at 560. The Novembers are the lead option now, and they settled 6.5 cents lower from that September contract, and they finished at 553.5. So there's a pretty good size disparity in there. Dave Dickey is here to talk about the numbers from the Board of Trade as they came across on the settlement prices from this Friday afternoon. How'd things fare, Dave?
Well, we saw quite a bit of pre-hedging as U.S. farmers are embarking on the 2004 harvest, particularly in that soybean pit ahead of what promises to be a heavy harvest weekend this week. Let's go ahead and get started and look at the particulars on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat had a high on the day of 341.5, a low of 331, settling 333.25, down 5. March, a high of 351.25, a low of 341.5, settling 343.75, down 5. May, a high of 355.5, a low of 346.5, settling 348.25, down 5.25. July wheat, a high of 355.5, a low of 347, settling 349, down 4.5. September wheat, a high of 359, a low of 352, settling 354.5, down 4 on the day. Corn grinding lower again for a sixth straight day. December corn, a high on the day of 217.5, a low of 215, settling 215.25, down 1. March, a high of 227.5, a low of 225, settling 225.25, down 1. May, a high of 233.75, a low of 231.75, settling 232, down 3/4. July, a high of 238.25, a low of 236.75, settling 237, down 1/4. September corn, a high of 243.75, a low of 242.5, settling 242.5, down 1. December 05 corn, a high of 250, a low of 248.5, settling 248.75, down 1 on the day. December oats, a high of 171.5, a low of 165.5, settling 165.5, down 6.5. March, a high of 175, a low of 170.5, settling 171, down 5.25. November soybeans, a high on the day of 561.5, a low of 552.25, settling 553, down 4.25. January, a high of 569, a low of 560, settling 560.5, down 4.75. March, a high of 577, a low of 566.5, settling 567.25, down 5.25. May, a high of 582, a low of 573.5, settling 574.5, down 3. July beans, a high of 586.5, a low of 578, settling 580, down 3.25. August, a high of 583, a low of 578, settling 580, down 3.5. October soybean meal, a high of 166, a low of 162.70, settling 163.40, down 40. December, a high of 167.70, a low of 164.30, settling 165.40, down 30. October soybean oil, a high of 22.50, a low of 22.07, settling 22.08, down 39. And December, a high of 22.29, a low of 21.84, settling 21.89, down 29 on the day. The prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And Todd, I see, particularly in that lean hog pit, the contracts are trying to catch up to the cash, and they did so in a big way today.
Yes, they did. They were up about $1.50 in the deferred months, but $2 higher in the nearby October contract. We'll get to those numbers in just a bit. In fact, if you want to look at the weekly changes as compiled by our own Dave Dickey, things were up pretty good in the lean hog pit, up around $6 for the week. Dave will be back in the closing market report this afternoon. About 20 minutes from now, he'll take a complete look at the agricultural markets. Of course, the closing market reports, or the agricultural news, that is. Of course, the closing market report coming up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. We'll talk with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities in Chalmers, Indiana, and some important information from the University of Illinois Extension Entomologist, an update of their yield card rootworm story. They're not quite sure that everybody's getting that story right as they first presented it when they put out their September issue of the Pest Management Crop Development Bulletin, which, by the way, is still online at www.ipm.uiuc.edu. This afternoon, we'll talk with Kevin Steffi about just exactly what they meant to say and what's being reported by a good deal of the press. Now, let's take a look at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Here we go. From the Merc, feeder cattle finished the September contract with a high of 114.75 for the day, a low at 114.10, settlement price there at 114.65. They were off a nickel. The October contract, a 112.5 high, a low at $111, and settled 111.90. They were off 65 for the day. November futures were 62.5 cents lower, had a high of 110.35, a low at 109.70, and settled $110.02 for the day. Once again, that November feeder cattle contract down 62.5 cents. From the live cattle pit, the October contract had a high today of 85.95, a low at 84.80. A settlement price at 85.45. They were down 97.5 cents on the day. And December futures, an 89.10 high, low at 87.40. Settlement price at 88.67.5, and they were off 77.5 cents. The nearby September's and November contracts did not trade for the day, so they were unchanged from yesterday's settlement prices. October lean hogs now 72, the high, the low at $70.25, settled up on that high of 72 even, up $2. December futures 69.30, the high, the low at 67.30, settled 68.82.5. They were up $1.52.5 at the end of this Friday afternoon. February lean hogs 67.90, the high for the day, low at 65.95, settled 67.62.5, up 157.5. In the April lean hogs, 65.50, the high, the low at 63.80, settled at 65.37.5. They were up 147.5. And finally, the February pork bellies for the day up the $3 limit, $99.07.5, the high, the low at 96.20, settled at 99.07.5. Once again, they were up the $3 limit for the day. I'll be back in just a moment with the weather forecast.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Kurt Fredrickson from Ogburn, Washington writes, "Dear Dr. Science, how do they empty empty calories and what do they fill the full ones with?"
Okay, the basic calorie is a one-celled animal, similar in spirit, if not shape, to the amoeba. Under a microscope, the calorie bears a striking resemblance to the actress Jane Fonda, though the calorie is many times smaller and has no political opinions. Unlike other cells, the calorie is full of nervous energy. When a simple drumbeat is piped into the microscope, the calorie is seen to move.